Any points you want to discuss? Oh, first.
I guess you mentioned the two truths at the beginning, and the other truth, which is a single truth, which is emptiness. And then I just couldn't pick up in the translation whether it was conventional truths, plural, or truth. Is it one single conventional truth, or is it...
No, whatever is not an ultimate truth is a conventional truth. The Buddhists use it as a noun, so there are multiple. That's the way it's presented. So they do talk about conventional truths,
mm-hmm.
or you can talk about singular conventional truth,
yeah.
dependent arising, right?
The microphone is not quite picking up. Thank you.
Does that fix it?
Yes, that's better. Thank you.
Okay, that was easy.
Yes, I just had one question about something that was mentioned last night. Vishwa spoke about the two types of meditation, and there was the replacement meditation. And he said that through the process of investigating and looking for a self, we engage in analytical meditation, and then through single-pointed concentration, that somehow becomes placement meditation. I don't quite understand how that process.
I know, we use analytical meditation to investigate how the I exists. You know, the example last night was going through the five aggregates one after another. Right, like I did the meditation this morning in relation to another person's person, not one's own person. It was exactly like that. We check up to see whether the form aggregate is a person, feelings, discriminations, and so on. And then we come to the realization that the five aggregates are the basis of designation of a person, right? We always refer to a person in relation to their body and mind, or the combination of body and mind. But when we analyze that basis, that which is suitable to be called a person, there's no person could be found. Certainly neither an inherently existing person, not even a conventionally existing person, can be found if we analyze. But mainly we're analyzing to see how the person appears to our mind as inherently existing. So if that can't be located, we come to the conclusion after that much analysis that the I does not exist as it appears to me. So we realize intellectually the emptiness. So having gone through that process, generating that intellectual realization of emptiness, then we single-pointedly or placement meditation focus the mind upon that understanding, upon the emptiness.
And does that create the experiential?
Sorry?
Does that then create the experiential understanding? From the
Well, what do you mean by experiential understanding? I missed that again.
I was just going to say that possibly to know without conceptualizing it or intellectualizing it.
Well, the intellectual understanding is an experience. You know, that is an experience. Then the direct realization is also an experience. You don't negate the intellectual understanding. That is absolutely essential to achieve the direct realization. So you need to focus upon your intellectual understanding again and again and again. Then, having that very firm in your understanding, then you have to engage in karma binding to cultivate karma binding. And once you've generated karma abiding, then you generate your intellectual understanding of emptiness, again, because you have nothing else, and you try to break through the conceptual understanding and get the direct awareness. So that's the progress towards direct realization of emptiness.
Because you talked about the imputation and how our minds perceive the object.
Yeah.
What affects this imputation?
What
factors affect the imputation?
Whenever we're talking about something or thinking about something, we identify that object through its name, right? A noun. We give a name to the object. So that is imputation. It means giving a name to the person or the external object, whatever it is, our object of awareness. That's the meaning of imputation, naming or labeling. Other than that,
I got the impression that you had an imputation from various aspects, not just the name, past history, your own mood, for example, things like that.
Yeah, every aspect of the person or every experience in our history, we give a name to those experiences and those things. We impute names. But the point is that things are merely imputed. Right? The mere imputation means that there's nothing from the side of the object which is the name. Now, it doesn't mean that the name is the object either. You have the conjunction of the basis of imputation and the imputing mind itself. So that which we impute never exists on the basis. That you have to sort out.
Imputation P.
Snivelling pigs. And that is the way things exist. So that's what we're talking about. You know, this Heart Sutra. In other words, that all phenomena are empty of existing in their own right, so whatever name they bear is the object established by that name can't be found. But conventionally, you know, ultimately, under ultimate analysis, it cannot be found. But conventionally, that non-ultimate existence does not negate conventional existence. So that's...
So how does that work? So then, from what you're saying, that our imputation is inherently wrong?
No.
At a higher level, but on a conventional level, it's right. That's how I'm
feeling this. No. The imputation, well, of course, you know, if there's an objection even in Buddhist schools that the things are merely imputed, then you can call an object, if you call an object which other people call dog, if you call it a lion, then it's got to be a lion, because it seems that things exist merely in dependence upon imputation. But that's not correct. giving the name does not create whatever we want, you know, whatever we impute. There has to be reasons for, and it's commonly accepted knowledge that it's reasonable to label a dog. Now that which we'll recognize as being suitable to be called a dog, as to call it dog. So what is that object which we call a dog? Is it a dog? Not from its own side. The correct way of identifying objects of imputation is to say that four-legged thing with a wagging tail is suitable to be called dog. Right? If it were dog from its side, then there would have to be something identifiable which is specifically dog, but that's not possible. So it's suitable to be called dog, but it's not dog. Dog is just a noun, it's just an imputation. But conventionally, in English, we'll accept the term dog to be correct. So the imputations are not inherently wrong. If it's conventionally agreed upon, that, you know, the names of things, that's correct, and that's the conventional reality. Is that all right? Yeah.
We talked about like emptiness being permanent.
Yeah, emptiness is a phenomenon, something which exists, and all phenomena are either permanent or impermanent. So emptiness belongs to the category of permanent phenomena.
So
unchanging.
So it's impermanent, but still it comes about through causes and conditions, because if we analyse emptiness itself, there's still the causes and conditions or the dependence. It's dependent on different aspects itself. So something permanent can be dependent.
There's no question emptiness is a dependent arising, but that doesn't mean it's impermanent. That doesn't mean it's causal, it's created by causes.
But it is created by causes.
What cause creates emptiness?
Lack of emptiness. Dependent arising, like it comes about through. Would you say a label and the lack of inheritance?
Emptiness exists in dependence upon imputation. Right? We call the phenomenon of non-inherent existence emptiness, right? So, yes, it is imputed. It's merely imputed by mind. But that imputation does not create emptiness. Causality talks about creation. So the imputation is a condition, but it's not a cause.
Condition but not cause. Wow.
That's cool. Well, the does the phenomenon emptiness of glass exist on this table?
No.
Does it exist now?
Yes.
So what is the condition has changed?
The condition of having a glass.
Yeah, there's the presence of a glass, what we call a glass. So, the emptiness of glass exists in dependence upon the glass. But it's not created by the glass.
Wow. So the condition of the life.
Yeah, in causality, you know, cause and effect in Buddhism, if something is a cause, which means it's a primary creator, you know, a primary cause for something to come into existence, and for something to be a cause, it has to be changing moment by moment, because a cause cannot become an effect without undergoing change. And so the primary cause of glass is the sand, you know, the quartz, which then under the conditions of heat and then the mould, the glass came about. So that sand, or that silicate, was the primary cause. And that surrogate itself has to be a result, an effect of a cause before that. So causality is the ongoing cause and effect relationship between impermanent, which implies impermanence, and that's the all the impermanent phenomena.
Yeah.
Whereas emptiness does not have a cause which is not emptiness, like a primary cause, but there are other conditions, like emptiness of glass depends upon glass, and also depends upon imputation.
Does emptiness have class? It has conditions, it doesn't have a cause.
When you use the term emptiness, you're talking about the generality.
Yes.
Emptiness. So there's emptiness of glass, emptiness of table, emptiness of me, emptiness of you. They're the different parts. And if you wanted to, you could say the emptiness of the bottom of the glass, the emptiness of the sides of the glass, and you can divide into parts from that point of view, the emptiness of the glass.
Okay, so the question is the use of merit to you hit a bit of a blockage in your understanding of these teachings.
Lack of merit.
The lack of merit.
Yeah.
Is actually the development of merit through purification practices?
Well, no. Purification removes the opposite of merit, like non-virtue.
Okay.
Which is also a block to achieving realization. So we do that, you know, through the purification practices.
Yeah.
And then the accumulation of merit is to, you know, do one of, you know, the many activities to accumulate merit. Mantra recitation, prostration, etc. And as Lama Tsongkhapa did, he had to, you know, the stories of his retreat, he made so many mandala offerings that the skin was worn off his forearm from polishing the slate. He had a bit of slate which he held the mandala on, and it's hard to believe. Well, we've got to believe it, but during this retreat he did so many things except sleeping, you know. Each day he did all these self-initiations and then hundreds of thousands of stuff. So that creates, that is a vital cause, an essential cause to achieve realization of anything.
So curate the merit, but also the purification as well?
Yeah, to remove the demerit, or the negative karmic, the obstacles, and to then accumulate the positive merit, the positive karma, to enable. And I often have my Lama Zogu Rinpoche say, when something some people they experience great difficulty in their Dharma practice, or they get so much and then they just give up, abandon. And Lama Zogu Rinpoche, I've heard him say, they ran out of merit. You know, Sangha disrobing, I've heard Rinpoche say about that, they just ran out of the merit to be ordained. merit is a vital component of our Dharma practice.
So recharging every day, every month, as much as you want.
Yeah, we should be conscious. I mean, look at Lama Zopa himself. You know, does not waste a second, you know, doing vast offerings. You know, like the story I often talk about, when, you know, when he was flying somewhere with Roger and the food was served in the plane. And Rinpoche was offering the food, like half an hour, three quarters of an hour. And then I was going to land, and the what do you call them these days? Not hostesses. The attendant, the flight attendant, came along to take it. And Roger said, "No, he hasn't eaten yet." And Rinpoche turned his head towards Roger and said, "It's okay. I've already received the benefit of the food." Because he made offerings, created merit. Of course, Roger had eaten, he gave up, and he ate his lunch while Rinpoche was still blessing. So that was a double lesson for Roger.
So the practice of avoid bowls, prostrations, deciding refuge, prayer.
Yeah. Yeah, the nyundras, that's why we do it. Yeah, that's the purpose of doing these practices, to purify obstacles and to curate merit for realization.
Okay.
Without that, you never get chine, you never get realization of emptiness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we talked about the physical aspect of our meditation.
Physical.
The physical side of it. With the dream state, if we took that in and we're awake in the dream state and we're doing meditation on emptiness and we're gaining antidotes through that level, is that more powerful?
To like practice Dharma in the dream state?
Mm.
I don't know how to judge whether it's more or less powerful. Obviously, it's a sign that one has been training one's mind during the waking state to be able to adjust one's behaviour in a dream. You know, I shouldn't do that, I've taken vows not to do that or whatever. And you can actually not do that. More powerful? I don't know how to judge. I think probably, it depends upon the individual. It depends how much bodhicitta or whatever they have and their reasons. But it's a good sign, I think.
So if we talk about imputation, so when you have imputations of monks, of deities, and of that on down that line.
Imputation. Yeah.
So does that mean that what you are doing in the daytime with your meditation is really getting deep to the consciousness level?
You mean if we understand that things are merely imputed?
Yes. And so say we impute a monk in our dream state, and we know.
What do you mean by you dream of a monk?
Yes, you dream of a monk.
Okay.
But the monk looks different to who you know it is.
Right, yeah, this, dreams are weird, yeah.
Yeah.
So for that, and I'm analysing that imputation. Okay, this is different. So I see the delusion. So then the single point is to concentrate on that. And then the whole scenario changes
again. Well, I mean, I don't know about the specific. I think if during our waking life, if we are practicing Dharma by watching, as I mentioned this morning, we're watching our thoughts and analysing our emotions. Why am I have aversion? Why do I have attraction, etc.? Then if we can bring that into a dream, even if the dream is bizarre, and they often are, it's a sign that we're developing a good habit to not believe as true the appearance of things, the way we take them to exist.
But we can still have the same delusion then as well.
In a dream?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. I mean, most dreams are a manifestation of attachment or aversion. Yeah. You know, just the mind playing games. And we may distort the object of our attachment or delusion onto something else, but that's essentially, that's what they are. I mean, there can also be other things. I mean, Buddhists can communicate, the guru can communicate with the students through dreams. But not every dream of the guru is an example of you communicating with your guru.
So once you, through practice, you'll get to know that anyway?
Well, sure. I mean, a teacher, before he went to Tibet, he had dreams of Tara appearing and talking to him in dreams and telling him what to do, what not to do, and that was valid. And even, you know, even in meditation, you can have visions. And so, a vision of a deity. So this can either be purely a mental projection, right, coming from his own mind. Or it can be a malevolent spirit appearing as your deity and causing some mischievous harm. Or it can be your deity. And there are methods in Tantra to ascertain which is which. So the same thing, I guess, in the dream. Dharma.
I just have a question about, with the emptiness teachings, is it said that we view everything as having inherent existence, normal?
Yeah, everything that appears to our mind appears as inherently existent. Everything.
So, for example, the new building up at the monastery. You know, in the past we saw that as an empty site. And then we saw that causes and conditions came to put the money together and build it with all the parts, you know, the floor, the walls, the roof, everything out. And then it was given a name. So knowing it's got those three components, how does that relate to seeing it as inherently existent? When we see it has causes and conditions, see it has parts, and we see it has a imputation.
Well, this is what we have to analyze. How does it appear as inherently existing? Oh, and you have a new baby. We know the causes and conditions that brought about that new baby. Inherently existing. It appears strongly as inherently existing, even before it's born. And this is what we have to check up and find out. What is this appearance of inherent existence? What is it? That which emptiness, the term emptiness, negates. This is big job.
So the term appearance, like for example, an appearance is something we see visually. So
no. It covers all the senses and even our thoughts. Whatever appears to mind. So it could be ear consciousness, eye, smell, taste, touch, or mental consciousness. So it's not just visual.
So even if you're apprehending that building,
and when you're thinking about that building,
thinking about the cause,
the image of the building appears as inherently existing.
Even though you're thinking about how it was constructed, the parts, and all that.
Yeah.
So how does that? Is it like an overlay?
Well, whatever it is we're thinking about, this is the obstruction to omniscience. This is the obscuration to omniscience. Due to the beginningless conditioning of our mind by ignorance, even when we wake up first moment in the womb, whatever appears to the fetus's mind appears as inherently existing. And so that we have to recognize. Even once you've realized emptiness, once you've directly realized emptiness, as soon as you come out of meditation, everything appears as inherently existing. Mm. Everything. It's only a Buddha who doesn't have that. A Buddha's mind.
What hope is there for us? are we meant to be discouraged by it?
There was a time when we were human beings, top of the class,
uh-huh,
and Buddha was a pig.
Oh.
So if that pig could get enlightened, why can't we?
Uh-huh. Well, I met the three pigs here. Yeah. This morning.
Well, let's beat them to it, okay?
Oh no, that's abusive. Yeah. So if everything that appears in our mind, which appears to be inherited existence.
Yeah.
When I look for a study of Dharma, okay, and I'm not saying that it's not valuable, but I can run the risk of seeing it as of inherited existence, so I should apply this to the Dharma itself, to the... Do you understand my question? Is that I don't want to be dismissive of the method here. I'm just saying, is there a risk that I get trapped because my mind is not developed at a high level, that I start to impute something to the Dharma which is not Dharma itself?
Yeah, sure.
Do you understand the question? Yeah.
Sure. Geshe-la said this morning, mm-hmm, that once we intellectually realize emptiness, that emptiness still appears as inherently existing. Emptiness!
It does.
Appears inherently existing.
Yeah.
It's only the direct realization of emptiness where you are actually perceiving emptiness. It cannot appear as inherently existing because you're directly seeing it. So it has to appear as non-inherently existing. But our intellectual understanding, what's appearing to the mind, is our mental image, our idea of emptiness. It's not emptiness itself. Yeah. And that image appears as inherently existing. Yeah. What time do we finish?
Ten
past two, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you were starting at 2:30.
Okay. Yeah.
Then I talked about the other, and it can. I just had a question about whether it can be the other can be. Seems like you could say it's external, but it's also internal. So the other may be our realizations through dependence on our teacher. We have we can develop compassion. Would that be?
Well, yeah. I mean, other just means not itself. So other can be anything.
So once
once we learn something from the teacher and we start to develop compassion in ourselves, is that other, or is it the actual teacher that...
No, the point of using the term other is that, you know, there are many synonyms for true existence, inherent existence, and one is existing in its own right. Right? So existing in its own right, the meaning of that is independent of anything else, existing independent upon itself.
Yeah.
Self-existence. So that is what is negated by emptiness. And other means something else. Something other things exist, not in their own right, but it depends upon something else. And that is dependent arising, that is the reality of existence. For whatever exists, exists in dependence upon something else, not in its own right. So, if we have generated compassion, sure, in dependence upon that compassion in our mind, many receiving the teachings, contemplating the teachings, meditating on the teachings, etc., especially on compassion. So we generate compassion in our minds. That compassion does not exist intrinsically from its own side, exists in dependence upon all those other conditions. So external, internal, secret. What's the secret condition? Again, I mentioned it this morning. Huh? No, wisdom, understanding emptiness. Understanding emptiness is a condition for developing compassion, and compassion becomes a condition for developing understanding emptiness. They mutually support each other. There are many reasons why wisdom helps develop compassion. We see through our own personal life, our own example, all of the mess-ups that we've made, all of our misery has come about through not understanding emptiness and believing the false appearance of things. So just as I have suffered, other people are suffering through similar lack of wisdom. So and it gives us, we can see the picture of the world, you know, the world today is pretty awful. We read the news, watch the news. So we understand that it's all, everything, terrorism, disease, is coming from lack of understanding emptiness of true existence and grasping the opposite. So the wisdom seeing that, you generate compassion. Yeah.
I was thinking about how Geshe Rakin talked about the meaning of bodhicitta. It was, he gave the Tibetan, was Chan Chuk Sen, Chan Chuk Sen, and Sen meaning mind. And before I started listening to these teachings, I thought of bodhicitta as an emotion, but here, an emotion. And then when I was thinking about this, I was thinking that it's sort of like if you're colorblind and you can't see yellow, for example, so you see reality in this way without yellow in it, and other people can describe to you what it really looks like with yellow, and you can read about it, but you can't see it. And then if you go to a doctor and he does some sort of procedure so that then you've got the full spectrum, so then you can see reality with yellow in it and you see it as it is. And so it made me think bodhicitta must be not an emotion, it's a state of looking at things. Is that right?
It's
not an emotion, it's like a way of looking at things.
Yeah. Bodhicitta is a primary mental consciousness, right? So we divide mind up into the six primary minds or main minds, mental consciousness, I, ear, and secondary mental factors which are, occur simultaneously. So, you know, we have a breakdown into 51 mental factors. And what we normally term emotions are, there are 11 virtuous mental factors, and there are the 6 root non-virtues and the 20 secondary non-virtues, and so on. So these normally we call emotions. Bodhicitta is a primary mental consciousness. It is not an emotion. It is not one of the mental factors. It is the mental consciousness. Out of the 6, it's the mental consciousness, and in its retinue it has the 2 aspirations: the aspiration to attain enlightenment and the aspiration to guide all sentient beings out of suffering. So those don't occur simultaneously, because the mind at any one moment can only have one object. So you can't have the aspiration to achieve enlightenment manifesting at the same time as the aspiration to lead all beings out of suffering. But the two are connected in that we generate the first, the great compassion, the taking upon oneself the responsibility to guide all beings from suffering, and then we realize that we can't do it because we're suffering. We have to get rid of our causes of suffering and become a Buddha to achieve that result. So what is concurrent with the manifest bodhicitta is the aspiration to achieve enlightenment. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of change and change as a concept. If change is a manifestation of emptiness,
if change
a manifestation of emptiness,
is change a manifestation of emptiness?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that sufficient?
Yeah.
Why? Why is change a manifestation of emptiness?
Well, if emptiness
that's right.
If I think about change and then how everything changes,
yeah,
if I think about emptiness, I try to put make it an entity of some sort so that I can kind of understand it.
Yeah, that's all right.
Rather than see, but if I think of emptiness as change, then
they're not the same thing. No, your question was, is it a manifestation of emptiness? Yes, but it's not. So what does emptiness mean?
It's an absence.
Huh?
It's an
absence. Absence, yeah, of what?
Absence of
inherent existence. Now, if something inherently existed, could it ever change?
No.
Okay, so change is dependent upon emptiness.
So space is inherently existent.
Huh?
Space?
Faith. Space, yeah.
It never changes.
Right. Then?
Is that inherently existent?
No.
Oh, well, it does change, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't change.
It doesn't change?
No.
Sorry.
But it's still not inherently.
Yeah, I think I am to judge shit. So that's why
I've got to
be very careful.
When we talk about space in Buddhism, we're talking about a non-affirming negation. A non-affirming negation means you negate something, but you don't affirm any entity, any positive entity. So space is the mere absence of obstruction. We're not saying that is just the definition of space. Now, the mere absence of obstruction is something which exists and exists throughout the universe, but it never changes. It doesn't have the activity of cause and effect. It's not created by anything. It's not destroyed by anything. It's just there. So, and it's empty of inherent existence. So change can only occur in the absence of inherent existence, but it doesn't mean that things necessarily change if they're empty of inherent existence. For example, space. Now, even non-obstruction, you can talk about the non-obstruction in the north side, east side, west, south side. And subjectively, of course, if we move around, then what was once north could be south, because we use a reference point according to the subjective observer, but that's not that doesn't change the fundamental reality of space.
A safe zone?
Yes. Safe for what?
No, I'm just saying like a...
You probably won't get a parking ticket if you...
It's neither
here
nor there. So,
Well, it's a mere absence of obstruction.
Yes.
Everything has its own space.
Yeah.
The walls, there's obstruction, but that obstruction is the wall. The wall couldn't be there if there weren't space there.
What about spirit people?
Spirit people?
Mm.
What about them?
I'm just thinking in terms of existence. You know, do they take up space?
Are you mean beings who are born as hungry spirits?
I name them as spirit people.
Hell, they're persons, even dogs are persons in Buddhism.
Yes.
And pigs.
And I agree with that, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
That's my perspective as well.
They have obstructive bodies.
Right.
But karmically, we're not, our human consciousness is not normally aware of them.
No, that's correct, yeah.
But they do have obstructive bodies, like one of the monks. And nuns' vows is to not throw stones because you might hit a hungry spirit. You can hurt them.
So they're actually taking up space.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They share this environment, but
yes.
We don't have the karma to perceive them.
No.
But they do have obstructive bodies.
Okay, thank you.
Mm.
So again, so if we're required to practice before an ounce of merit and wisdom to reach Buddhahood and understand this reach Buddhahood, and we can only hold one thing in our mind at a time.
Yeah.
We swap backwards and forwards between the two, or is there one one needs to develop first before the other one comes?
Yeah, no. simultaneously, not exactly the same time, but you know, every, the, like prostration has the two activities. If we're doing the visualization properly, then we're purifying, because that's the actual visualization. So you're doing the 35 Buddhas, you're actually purifying negative karma. And at the same time, by reciting the names of the Buddhas, you're accumulating merit. So this is why you should verbally recite the names quite loudly.
So in fact, that's what... Body, speech, and mind. Is that what we're purifying?
Yeah. 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 And that was a big mistake that Lama Tsongkhapa made during his big retreat. When he recited the names, he left out Daishin Shepa, the Arhat, the... I forget what Daishin Shepa literally, but he left out the title. And that, so he, I think, I can't remember exactly the story, but during that retreat, he had a vision of the 35 Buddhas. They didn't have heads, just their bodies, because he left out the Daishin Shekpa. But the first lines, you memorize in English, the foe destroyer, whatever.
So
prostrating the 35 Buddhas does both accumulates merit and purifies.
So why did he leave that out? If he would have been
just... Why did he leave that? Well, I don't know. But that's a, he probably just did it as an example for us to not leave it out.
Purify all aspects, not...
Yeah, I think it was the vision that the heads weren't there. Do you remember that, sir?
I think that's it.
Yeah.
I think the last part of Geshe-la's teaching, you talked about to progress in the middle way, we need two things, the object, emptiness, and then the subject, the wisdom, realizing emptiness. So, assuming that, is that the mind, and then the object of looking at the...
There's a subjective mind realizing emptiness, and the object emptiness.
The object that we're
that's what the subjective mind is realizing. I remember him saying that, but I drifted away the context of why he said that.
We said to progress in the middle way rather than to progress. We need two things. We need the object and the subject. But just, the wisdom realizing emptiness must be the mind apprehending, the mind observing, analyzing.
Yeah, wisdom is.
To the object, looking at each object.
Yeah, it's a subjective mind. Yeah.
So the wisdom of the subject of the emptiness of the object.
I can't remember what brought up that statement. Oh, my mind was drifting. I know he said that, that you have to differentiate between the two, the subjective mind realizing emptiness and the object emptiness, which is realized. Okay. But does anybody...
He said to progress along the path of the middle way, we need the view of the path.
Right.
The view of the path has two parts, the object, which is emptiness, and the subject, which is the wisdom realized.
Realizing emptiness.
And emptiness is... Like it's
the wisdom
realizing.
Sure. Well, that is the path.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that must be it, isn't it? I don't want to give you time for a break. Okay. Thank you. Good luck with the three doors of liberation.
Thank you.